Hi, Bobby here. In what is an uncertain time for all of us, I'm just recording this brief message to acknowledge the ways in which the pandemic and related social distancing may already be affecting you. This episode is on the power of friendship as a positive factor on our mental health, and I've certainly taken the recent changes as an opportunity to speak to friends more on the phone or via messaging. It's really helping me navigate this surreal experience and feel more connected. So with that said, I hope you find this episode interesting. It's a good one, and while some of the discussion around making new friends may not be feasible right now, we also talk at length about strengthening existing friendships as well. This is also a prime opportunity to binge old episodes. From next week, we will be covering COVID-19 in relation to mental but also physical health in an attempt to dispel many of the misconceptions that are causing increased stress. We will not be reducing the frequency of episodes, but will work to include lighthearted discussions plus tips for those self-isolating. Connection matters, so keep talking. Others will appreciate hearing from you.
This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about friendship as a factor in mental health with author and therapist Hope Kelleher. She was a really great guest for this topic, having written a whole book all about the barriers to making new friends and developing friendships as an adult, and also how conditions like social anxiety and other mental illnesses can impact our ability to create strong, healthy relationships in general. So first off, I just wanted to read some general information from the Mental Health Foundation on friendship. Friendship can play a key role in helping someone live with or recover from a mental health problem and overcome the isolation that often comes with it. It's natural to worry when a friend is troubled, and most of us don't want to give up on a friend in distress, however difficult it may be to support them. Many people who do manage to keep their friendships going through experiences of mental illness find that they are stronger as a result. So is there anything you wanted to add on that first off?
I mean, it's just an absolute battlefield. The things that I've been through in my life, thank God for some of my friends that have, you know, stuck by me. But it must be quite awkward, you know, at times, knowing what to say and what to do and how to be. I'm putting my other head on, you know, as the friend. Sometimes, you know, when you're in a good place, you look, I do think about my friends and my relationships and think, wow, you know, bless them, really. It's hard going.
Yeah, it certainly can be. And like we talk a little bit in the interview about, we don't come with these skills by default. Yeah. The challenges of communicating with someone when they're going through mental illness, we have to learn, really. Because when it's something that, for the most part, we're experiencing internally, it can affect the friend's ability to communicate in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
But interestingly, the Mental Health Foundation also highlight how often the strongest relationships that come out of mental illness are with those that have similar experience. Mm. And so there is the potential bonus there. You know, they've mentioned these friendships can be stronger from surviving challenges.
It must be really beneficial if you live with anxiety and you come across or meet somebody else that goes through the same thing. There really is a common ground and probably somebody that really understands what you're going through. But even within anxiety, we know it's so diverse. However, if you're somebody who lives with psychosis, for example, or somebody that doesn't know how to articulate their mental illness, really struggling or been sectioned lots of times, I think then the friendships and relationships can become very strained and people become very isolated.
I think that's very true, that it can depend on the extent to which you can articulate what's going on.
Yeah.
That these friendships can be really built if you're able to clearly get across, okay, these are the challenges I'm facing. Here's the things that may upset me. Here's a few things to say or to not say. But that puts a lot of responsibility on the friend going through the mental illness. So I think perhaps if you do have the advantage of both experiencing the same condition, a lot of that can kind of go unspoken.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you have enough perspective to see, okay, this is my symptoms, these are my challenges, they're probably going to be similar for my friend.
Yeah.
I think that really helps. But As we'll talk about in the interview, there's a lot of universal things we can all do to be more understanding and build these better friendships to really just support us in general, whatever you're going through. I think that's really powerful.
You know, I'm really into like being proactive and having friendships, you know, as many quality relationships around you with people with similar interests or whatever, anyway, you know, so that when things may go wrong or problems occur throughout your life, that you've got them to fall back on. I think quite a lot of us can get isolated, especially as they get older, whether you get married or you have a relationship or children or just older age in general. There's a lot of research that find people become more isolated. And I just think that, you know, having that a network around you anyway is beneficial.
Yeah, it certainly makes it a lot easier when you do have life challenges. Mm-hmm. You have more options then on who can support you, and potentially a bigger group, because at times it can be really challenging. The kind of support we need when we're at our darkest time can be quite draining for other people to give. And so having more friendships around us or just relationships in general can really help balance that out.
Yeah.
Particularly when we can often be feeling quite self-conscious anyway, that we may be a burden to people.
Absolutely.
And that's another thing that the Mental Health Foundation highlighted as well, that people with mental health problems often anticipate rejection from other people because of the stigma associated with mental health. They may therefore avoid social contact as a form of self-stigma.
Mm.
And self-stigma we've talked about a lot in terms of how we can internalize these fears. And so I'm really glad they've highlighted it in this way as well, that often we do feel like we're a burden when we're going through things and we do anticipate this kind of rejection.
Yeah, we do. But it's funny because we've spoken about this a lot, haven't we, Bob? Like, it's not always because you are worried about what people might think, which is what I see as stigma. You just don't want being a burden or feeling like you're a burden. Your friends and family may be really open to it. You may even be around people who are mental health practitioners, or your friends may have gone through their own stuff. It might just be that you don't want to offload to them at times.
Yeah, I think that's very fair, that the danger of self-stigma is you don't really know if it's real or not. Like, if you've picked it up from stigma in general, or maybe from like one or two interactions you've had, you're just then putting that on the future. You're anticipating a kind of rejection that may not actually be real.
Yeah.
And that can be really damaging. When it can be challenging enough to open up about mental health struggles, if you're then actively expecting a rejection, it may just hold you back from talking altogether.
Mm.
And so that's certainly, you know, very much what we try and eradicate here on the show.
Yeah.
But that's not to say it is easy and that there aren't those kind of rejections. So there was a study the Mental Health Foundation did, and 4 in 10 service users were worried about telling their friends about their problems. Me being an optimist, I see a stat like that and I looked it up, and the other side was that 6 in 10 weren't worried about telling their friends. So it's difficult to know to what extent that fear actually relates to how the friends would react or the stigma that's in the air that we can easily pick up. But that threat is very real for a lot of people. So another finding was that 1 in 3 felt friendships had become strained or been lost because of their mental distress. So in that way, the stigma is very tangible and the fears are understandable.
Yeah, and if they're your mates, you know, come on. But then a lot of it, again, is people don't know how to act, as opposed to being like, well, if you've got anxiety, this party ain't for people with anxiety, so see you later. Like, surely your friends are going to be. But, you know, that's me being naive, perhaps.
No, my own experiences. I think that is fair. Your friends are going to be biased towards trying to understand you.
Yeah.
You know, that is a part of friendship, is trying to understand each other as best you can. So in that way, absolutely, you are going to be safer on balance talking to a friend compared to talking to a stranger.
Mm.
It is such an important topic. And why I was so keen to cover it is because of the darkest side of this is the isolation that you've described.
Mm.
And the stigma can create a self-isolation. And that really worries me, that people could be cutting themselves off from friends that could be very supportive, or from making new friendships because of how they assume people are going to act, and tarnishing everyone with the same brush of what the worst case scenario could be.
Mm.
And that really comes across And that concern really is illustrated in the last stat I'll read, also from the Mental Health Foundation. They found in the study that 1 in 20 friends only became aware of their friends' mental health struggles when they first attempted suicide.
Wow.
And so that, in a very tangible way, highlights how dangerous the isolation around mental illness can be. So the upside of that more sobering note is that in the interview with Hope, we talk all about loads of great strategies to overcome that potential isolation, to keep your friendships going and to make new ones even when you're struggling with mental illness. And as the listeners will hear, she's really proactive in terms of like just how many tips she packs into speaking to us, but also in terms of the book she wrote all about how to make friends.
It's cute, isn't it? Because it's like, it's just something we take for granted, how to make friends, especially as you get older. Like, you don't kind of, you're not like, I want to make some new friends. Like, maybe if you move to a new city or you do something new, you might be like, I know I need to get out there and meet some people. It's like this way of putting it out there. Like, I just need to meet some people, you know, get out there. But actually, trying to make some new friends and just not said as much in adulthood as it is when you're a kid, you know?
So yeah, there's not as much of a focus on, like, constant maintaining of a friend group as when particularly you're at school. It can lead us to try and put too much into our relationships and try and get everything from one person.
From one person. No. As Esther would say, we need different things from different people. It's so true. And again, I know I keep saying as you get older, maybe I'm not showing my age all the time on this podcast, but as you get older, you become, you know, you're married or you're not, you've got a partner, you've got kids, and then you go to work and that's it. What about your friendships? You know, it's so easy to not have that.
Right. And we're aware that we're both coming from a similar perspective on this, both being more extroverted people. And that's something we talk about quite a lot in the episode, that the different approaches to building friendships and friend groups, depending on introversion versus extroversion. So someone like myself, I'm very extroverted, so I feel really energized and pumped by spending time around a lot of people. And in fact, I like to be around people as close to 24 hours a day as possible. I'm very much the extreme end of the spectrum, but that is where I find my energy. And whereas people that are on the more introverted side need more recovery time from social situations. They need more time to be on their own and to recharge from solitude. Whereas to me, recharging is being around other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not actually to say that from a friendship point of view, one is better or worse. I may be more naturally proactive with gathering as many friends as possible. But often the people I'm making friends with most are introverts, because these are the people that kind of balance out my perspective and approach to life and maybe calm me down a little bit when I need to. So the fact that I most enjoy one-to-one interactions with people and actually don't enjoy being in big groups is actually
quite an introverted preferred way of being, actually.
It is. It's quite an introverted trait.
I was actually quite surprised over the time when you describe yourself as extremely extrovert. I've always not been that sure. Interesting, isn't it? You know, you always fight to be heard. And I'd have a little tip out there for any extrovert or somebody who thinks they're more extroverted listening. Don't be fooled by that quietness of an introvert. You know, they're powerful people.
They'll be thinking away.
They've a lot to say. If only us extroverts shut up for a minute and give them a chance to actually speak. They've actually probably got a lot more wisdom than we often think they have, because they just don't need to say it all the time, you know?
And on the theme of extroversion versus introversion, because I'm stammering today a little bit, Danielle is going to introduce the episode.
So now we'll get into the episode with Hope Kelleher. But first,
who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
We get a lot of mixed messages from the media, so it's good to have a source you can rely on. That's why we're recommending The Economist, which covers a host of topics, not just economics and finance. I've found it incredibly helpful recently to dispel many of the myths surrounding COVID-19, and it includes loads of stats on the actual nature of this threat, plus what the societal and economic impact could be. You already know I love stats as a great way to inform your own perspective and get the real story. So read The Economist and it will keep you posted on cultural and financial shifts across the world with how they relate to you. You can even try a free print copy as one of our listeners. Just text health to 78070. That's the word health to 78070. This is a no obligation free offer, so do give it a try. Details are in the episode description. The Economist, an essential guide to the forces changing your world.
Hi, Bobby. I'm Hope Kelleher. Thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm very excited to be here. My earliest experiences of having an anxiety challenge probably started when I was about 6, following the loss of my father. So my father died when I was 6, and in my family of origin, you know, my family did not believe in getting like therapy or family counseling. And it's, you know, that's sort of what led me into mental health, was because I think that my anxiety would have been much diminished had my family gone to see a family therapist to really manage the impact of my father's loss on the family system and treating the grief related to it. And so, you know, I would say that my anxiety has always been something that I've worked to manage, and I talk about it quite freely because it is something that has impacted me. And I think it probably got to its greatest point when I was in high school, getting ready for college and, you know, really just having so much anxiety that it would prevent me from sometimes like going to class, or I would, you know, feel like I would have to study and over-prepare for my exams. And that can be quite debilitating and sometimes prevented me from doing other things like hanging out with my friends or ruminating about my worries to my friends. And so I think that's sort of when it became a little clear that I was really suffering from anxiety. And, you know, I worked with my high school counselor to talk a little bit about it. And then when I went to college, I utilized mental health services at Johns Hopkins, which was helpful. And I would say, you know, currently as a therapist, you know, you want to do the walk. So I am also in therapy. I've participated in like couple therapy and individual therapy. And so I'm a real believer of it. A few years ago, just before my mom passed away, she was in some therapy while she was dealing with cancer and had shared with me regret of not having participated in family therapy when me and my sister were smaller, and was kind of proud that I was a therapist. So that's sort of the evolution of my own experience of managing my anxiety and sort of why I became a therapist to begin with.
So that was really great background. Thank you for that. The two experiences of grief you mentioned with your parents there, did you find that because of your work and how active you are in talking about mental health, that the family in general handled your mother's death differently?
You know, I think that my experience with therapy, you know, is sort of a more individual one. I think that being in therapy at the time of my mom's passing and currently being in therapy, you know, has really helped me just manage some of my grief symptoms, put it in perspective. And I do think it does help that I am a therapist and that I do treat people who are grieving. So I think that has really just helped me experience grief very differently. You know, my father's passing was a sudden death. He passed away of a heart attack, and my mom struggled with cancer for a number of years. So it's a very different type of grief that I've experienced.
Right. And when you look back, are you able to tell in what ways the grief and your anxiety symptoms interacted from that young age?
Totally. I think the greatest difference is the shock, right? When it's a sudden loss, there's a lot of shock. There's a lot of things that it's hard to make sense of. You know, for me, I think if I were to experience like a sudden loss of somebody I love now, it would be probably more traumatic than maybe like the prolonged grief. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk about this a lot with some of my clients who, you know, have a diagnosis or whose family members have a diagnosis, and the prolonged grief, you know, you're grieving the loss of the person sometimes while they're still there. And so it's a very different animal from my own personal experience, like the sudden loss of somebody versus like the prolonged loss. But in terms of my anxiety, I think, you know, definitely the shock and not knowing of what's going to happen when you're little and you experience a death like that, you kind of are always worried that something's going to shift suddenly. And I totally think that that contributed to my anxiety. But I also think changing the family system in such a way, and at that time, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and so my father was the sole income earner. You know, the way my anxiety manifested was that I really wanted to like study hard. I wanted to go to a good college. And so in some ways, that's how I channeled my anxiety, which is for some like a really good way to cope. But for others like me, sometimes it becomes so overwhelming that like I would stay home from school to study, you know, because that just became so important, you know. And yeah, so that's sort of how I think my anxiety manifested. And, you know, through meditation and exercise and therapy, I now can identify when I'm having those feelings of anxiety and name it, which I think is huge when you're suffering, right? Because most of us walk through this world having so many feelings and not really understanding what they are.
Right. Wow. There's so many good points you've made there. That always happens when I interview therapists, actually. It seems to be a sign of the job that because when you're in the room, you do hardly any of the talking compared to the client usually. You're so good at them packing in all these insights. So the two things I wanted to pick up on was, first off, what you mentioned about an area of grief that can be quite hard to wrap your head around, which is situations where it's more prolonged and there's that anticipation of grief. You can start to prepare for it mentally ahead of time. That can be quite a difficult thing to describe, but you've done that really well. Also, what you mentioned about the origin of a lot of your anxiety being the unexpected nature of your father's death makes a lot of sense, because even before you talked about it, that was kind of where my assumption was going. And it's something that a few of our guests have talked about. They've been through things that many might describe as the worst case scenarios. And a condition like anxiety is so much about fixating on worst case. So then when, as a young child, you've been through that, it can be just so much more embedded, the anxiety, and so much harder to then unpick.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not cured from my anxiety in any regards, but I think I'm just better equipped to be able to name it and to share with others, you know, especially my close friends who have known me forever since it became bad in high school, really just talk about it and, you know, getting a lot of affirmation from them, because the reality is that we all experience the same feelings just at different times and to different degrees. And I think anxiety, at least in my practice and, you know, as a human, is something that we, as a human living in New York City, I think is just something that we all experience. One of, I think, the challenges, you know, for me as a child, like I knew what I was anxious about. But a lot of people I see come in and they're presenting with signs of anxiety when it's sort of multifaceted, right? Because a little bit of anxiety gets us to study for that test, to pay our bills, to come to work. But too much can actually spiral into depression where it's really debilitating. And so fortunately, I feel like I had enough support that I wasn't completely debilitated when I was like a young person, you know, in my late teens and early 20s. Suffering from anxiety, but I completely have seen that often where people become so anxious that the anxiety really overcomes them. And then they end up feeling like they can't get out of bed in the morning, or they can't find enjoyment from things that they used to find pleasure in.
Right, absolutely. And in that way, that's very much where it can cross over in depression and even the way you've described it there. But I think that's a really great point about the different levels of these feelings, that to a degree, we can all relate to many symptoms of mental illnesses, but it's about what level is functional and is part of being a human and being alive, and what part is then interfering with your day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And that's where it really becomes a problem. And so to come on to the theme of today's episode being friendship, do you mind sharing a little bit more about how your friends were supporting you in high school that you mentioned?
Totally. And maybe even like before high school, I remember I would have these state tests and I would call a friend who lived down the street, and, you know, I would sort of share my worry or my anxiety, or, you know, what do you think is going to be on the test? Like blah, 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 blah. And he'd be like, Hope, it's totally okay. You're going to be fine. And so getting that validation from peers who I had studied with, who, you know, who kind of knew me, was always helpful. You know, one of my best girlfriends now would actually let me like hang out in her car and study, you know, during off periods or study halls. So, because she's like, you know, I know that you're suffering from anxiety. I know you can't sit in the library with other people. You're a very chatty person. You know, so she was like actually really supportive in that way. And I think, you know, just friends validating the feelings of anxiety, because that's actually huge, right? So, you know, being shut down or being told, oh, you'll be fine. I mean, that might be helpful, but for me, what's been the most helpful is for people saying, yeah, like, I can really see that you're suffering and I totally get it. This is scary, whatever it is, right? This is scary. It's nerve-wracking, but like, you're gonna be okay. So it's the both end, getting that affirmation, but also having my friends really validate my experience has been helpful, and vice versa. You know, me being able to validate my friends' experiences, like if they're going through a breakup and, you know, and they're feeling anxious or about something about work, like really just kind of sitting in that discomfort with them, I think has been really helpful for like myself included.
Yeah, that sounds really great. But it is difficult, isn't it, to get that balance right? So would you have any tips for people in terms of how to get that level of validation right, that you want to take people's feelings and empathize with them and show understanding, but then you also don't want to maybe validate them to the extent where you're agreeing with unhealthy behaviors? So if their answer to how they're feeling is, I've just got to like stay in bed all day and hide from the thing, you're not going to validate that.
Right. I think that's actually a very good yet tricky question to answer. And I think, you know, I think that you really have to think about what, you know, Kristen Neff, who writes a lot on compassion, she's a researcher. She talks a lot about compassion. And one of her recommendations is for you to talk to yourself as though you were your own best friend. And so I think that the flip side of that, in finding that balance between like when to validate and support somebody and then when to give them the reality check, like, hey, I'm concerned, I haven't seen you around, you're isolating yourself, is, you know, what would you want your friend to do for you, right? And so for me, I think it's, you know, the validation and also that reality check, like, hey, hope you actually, this is not something you need to like really worry about because you're okay, right? So I think it's like what you would want other people to do for you and thinking about how that might play a role in how you interact with others.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And certainly something I try and do is balance out empathizing with the feelings, but not necessarily validating inaccuracies. So there's a middle ground for me where I can feel bad for a friend because of their levels of anxiety without confirming, yes, that should stress you out to this level.
Right.
And that's right. Been something that I've very much had to kind of learn that balance, like we all do. You know, there's not, unfortunately, a level of understanding around mental illness that we're born with. So it is a process of learning.
And I also think that there's a role for asking for what you need sometimes, getting that balance between validating and helping friends out of a really difficult time. You know, I think that not only approaching others as you would want to be approached is helpful, also reminding people that, you know, leaning too far into one feeling or another can sometimes not be good. And so, you know, I'm thinking about some of my friends of late where they've had some life course changes, like a miscarriage or a failed relationship or job stress, where, you know, as their friend, like you want to allow space for those heavy feelings, whether it's anxiety or depression or disgust or frustration or anger, but also reminding people that, you know, not to lean so far into those feelings, right? I think we've all seen it where we have like a friend who's maybe broken up and they're, you know, really wallowing in the sadness of that loss. And that's okay, but to really help friends not lean too far into that. And so, you know, remind it, like for me, like an easy reframe for some of my friends who've had this experience is really just reminding them that, you know, the glass can be half full. It's a matter of perspective, which I know can be challenging when somebody's really suffering, but that is also one way to strike that balance.
Yeah, absolutely. And something I've had to do in both knowing what to ask for, like you've described, when I need support, but also in being a good friend, I've had to learn what I can offer and what I'm good at communicating with. Mm-hmm. I'm a very optimistic and solution orientated person. So mm-hmm. I've found that there are times when people aren't in a position to be receptive to my perspective. You know, my positivity is just going to come off as invalid fantasy compared to their reality of how tough life is at the moment. And so I've had to learn there's times when just sitting in the feelings and listening to them is what I can offer. And that then I'm the friend they can come back to when they're ready to make a plan. And then I'll already have one locked and loaded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, you make me think about when I really need to be held by a friend, I know exactly like the best person to do that. If I need to talk about relationship stuff, you know, I know the best like friend in my world to do that. If I need to talk about financial stuff, I know another person, right? So kind of knowing who in your world might be more helpful to you in that moment, I think also helps strike that balance, right? Because sometimes, and I totally do this too, and so my friends who are listening, I love you. Thank you for your patience. But sometimes, you know, we all can be a little needy, right? And, you know, you want to try to balance that out amongst your friends because that can be quite overwhelming if you have one or two close friends to always take on. So that's another way to sort of get some balance, I think. And so being a support to your friends and also being a supportive friend.
I think that's so true. And also in finding the skills and what you gain from different relationships in your life, it's also healthier when it comes to romantic relationships and relationships with family members as well. That so often, particularly with romantic relationships, there can be a pressure to get everything from that person. We're sold this kind of Hollywood narrative that you meet that person and then you get your happily ever after. That ignores everyone else, you know, that like the best friend sidekick also gets married off. And what it leaves out of the story is the friendships and what you gain from other people in your lives as well. So I certainly think from my perspective, part of the reason why I'm so comfortable being single is because I have a really good support network of friends, because I'm getting so much from the relationships I already have. So that a romantic relationship would be like the cherry on top, as opposed to like filling a hole, which we're sort of encouraged at times to approach relationships in that way.
Totally. And I, you know, Bobby, as a couples therapist, time and time again, I see couples who, especially couples who've been together for many years, like maybe they dated in high school or in college, where they've sort of grown up together, and that does become the narrative that their partner is their all and everything. But to your point, you cannot be somebody's all and everything all the time. And, you know, I think a big part of my work is helping couples on some level individuate. You know, so often I get a couple that comes in where there's maybe not codependence, but I would maybe call it codependence, and that other part of the couple really needs to go and develop that network, right? So filling in that gap, to your point, and that becomes harder as we get older, you know, and especially when people have children or move to a new city. And so I think it actually reiterates the importance of friends. And on another note, because like our communities are so, you know, you're not a communal society as we once were, or as communal, you know, our kinship families, you know, sometimes can be hours away from us. Sometimes it's just that one FaceTime call on the weekends or what have you. But thinking about friends, the evolution of friendship into something like that's a functional family. That's how I, you know, having lost both of my parents at a relatively young age, you know, I really think of my friends as my family. And I think that's something that, to your point, that sometimes we don't really think about. But if we did cherish our friends as family, I think so many lives would be, you know, so enriched.
I think that's really powerful. And I love that idea of choosing your family. It's certainly something I've done. And at times it is necessary that there are things that you need to go out into the world and find. I rarely come across people that found everything they needed in the family they were born with. And I think in many ways that's natural and right, because that is something that encourages us to branch out and find new relationships. And what was the other thing I was going to say? And I'm glad that you also mentioned codependence there, because we've only recently covered that on an episode. And I think you made a really good point about getting different support outside of the relationship as well, because so often we can feel tempted, particularly if we're codependent, to double down on the relationship when things are challenging. But actually that can create an unhealthy amount of pressure, that we're, you know, wanting to spend twice as much time with somebody, talk to them even more as a way to almost iron over any issues. And actually spending time getting an outside perspective and getting quality time from people outside of that relationship may actually take a lot of the pressure off.
Totally.
And so a lot of people may be listening to us talking about our great supportive friends and think about whether or not they have that in their own life. And I know in your book, you've shared a lot in terms of how to make friends and the challenges around doing that as an adult as well.
Sure. So, you know, what the research indicates, and I highlight this in my book Here to Make Friends, How to Make Friends as an Adult, is that as we transition through our life, we come into contact with a variety of institutions that are really helpful at making friends, right? So when we're kids on the playground, I think most of us have had this experience where either we go up to somebody or somebody comes to us and says, oh, hey, you want to be my friend, or come over here and play? And that's easy, right? Because mm-hmm. we are around people are, you know, of our own age at that point who have some similar interests. And that, as you know, evolves, right? So our elementary school friendships might be different from the friendships that we have in adolescence, which might be different from the friendships that we have, you know, in college or university. And so what really inspired me to write this book was that I have just seen so many people graduate from school, come to new cities, and they're really alone and really trying to, you know, people struggle without having those institutions, like kind of feeding those friendships, right? And so, and I'm sure you have had a similar experience, right? Like,
and also the dynamic changes, like the question of let's be friends isn't one that is socially acceptable as an adult. So our approaches also have to evolve.
Totally. And so, you know, in my book, I really talk about ways, a variety of ways and opportunities for people transitioning, you know, in and out of these institutions to meet new people who are like them, to develop their own self-esteem and desire to interact and engage with people. And I also like offer some strategies and then some like actual concrete opportunities and ways to meet new people, because it definitely changes.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the time people can feel held back from some of the reasons they may want to expand their friend group. It can, particularly when mental illness is thrown into it and you may be feeling more self-conscious or less worthy in general, to then make the decision that I need a bigger friend support network could feel quite selfish to people when they're in those dark places in their head.
Totally. I think that, you know, for a lot of the people I see who are struggling with mental illness, friendship of utility might mean the person who can go to the NAMI meeting, the National Association of Mental Illness meeting with, or maybe, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous with, or just somebody that you can talk to who can identify your own experience. But then you might have other friendships of pleasure as well.
Right. And also within that, it's perfectly natural for your needs to change when you're experiencing mental illness. It's quite common that when people experience mental illness, particularly long term, they can connect easier with people that have had that same experience. And I think that's perfectly acceptable and a part of just growing older in general, that the friendships you have change. You get closer to other people and you maybe drift and your lives diverge from others.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And, you know, friendship is ever evolving. And yeah, you know, you will have different types of friendships. And, well, the hope is that people can have like those 1 to 2 friends or 1 to 5 friends that really can understand them, right, on that deeper level. And so if you have a history of having hospitalizations, you know, or like, you know, having your meds changed a whole bunch, like, because that's exhausting. And some friends who don't have those experiences will not really be able to fully understand your lived experience. And I think that is one of the most important things in the human connection, is really being fully understood.
There's nothing else that can quite validate you in that way. And so in a sense, it's a really great skill that can come out of some of the darkest experiences, that it gives us a level of insight and empathy towards others. And so one thing we touched on a little bit earlier was the challenges of making friends as an adult. I, being a very extroverted person, I think take for granted how much effort I put into my friendships. But I think for a lot of people, whether it's to do with mental illness or whether it's to do with more of their life approach, like being introverted, find that a lot more challenging. Do you mind sharing in what ways you've come across that?
I would say the number one thing I hear on my couch and in my world is that social anxiety is a huge barrier to people trying to make friends. And that, you know, these are people who really want to make connections. You know, I was just talking last week to somebody about, you know, they have this strong desire to connect with other people, but they really get too in their head. And then they start to have like a negative narrative about how they're coming across, what they're looking like, how they're sounding. And so that's sort of what can really happen to people suffering from social anxiety, is that they tend to really get in their head and stop focusing on the encounter because they're so afraid of being rejected. So that, I would say, is a huge barrier.
Right. And that one is actually quite self-perpetuating as well, that if you're so focused on what's happening internally, what you're not focused on is the other person and the interaction.
Like a tip that I actually really recommend is that so few of us actually have people in our lives who are good listeners.
Mm-hmm.
That if you are somebody who's socially anxious and you're engaging with somebody, just try to focus on them, right? Because they're probably just wanting somebody to listen to them. And that can be affirming and help people get really out of their head. Just really listen to the other person. Try not to start to think about what you're going to say, right? Because really kind of, you know, one of the themes I think in our conversation, Bobby, is that people just want to be validated,
mm-hmm.
authentically validated. And so instead of like ruminating or worrying about the next thing that you're going to say to engage in that conversation, you could just validate that, right? You know, I was thinking a couple weeks ago, I was at this party and I too am a little bit more on the extroverted side, so I don't have this challenge. I also talk to people for a living, so I'm well practiced. You know, I was watching somebody who is a bit socially awkward and I know suffers from social anxiety engage with a new group of people. And what this person did really well was instead of maybe just joining into the conversation, you know, really validating that person's experience by saying like, oh yeah, you know, hey man, that must have been really tough. I'm sorry that you had to go through it. And then that person was able to really kind of be welcomed into the group and you know, was seen, right? Just because that person validated this other person's experience. So my book has a couple of other tips for people who are suffering from social anxiety. You know, here's the reality, is that most people want to have more connections. Even if you're on the more introverted side, that doesn't mean that you don't want quality connections, right? It's just a personality approach that's a little bit different, which is a little different from social anxiety, from my perspective.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. We all want to connect more. We all want to feel that our experience is reflected. And so often that's shows in the way people interact, that we find ways to divide ourselves into groups of like-minded people. We tend to follow people through our social media who we more commonly agree with. And so actually, we're all out here trying to find connection. And that's why I love that you've brought up listening, because that's so key. If we can focus more on being a good listener and really taking in what people are saying, we'll find so much more to connect with. There's so many universal human experiences that we can pick up with just, you know, giving people the chance to tell us about their lives.
Another thing that I recommend for people suffering from social anxiety is definitely meditation, but also really like practicing engaging with other people on sort of like a low risk level. So, you know, just the other day I was also in the elevator with somebody who suffers from social anxiety, and we were talking about how something was going on with the elevator, and it was a really good opportunity to just practice like off the cuff conversation. And so that person sort of used that as a teachable moment, because opportunities just to practice engaging happen all around us. And I really encourage people to take the low hanging fruit and to kind of go for it, whether it's somebody at the coffee shop or, you know, in the store, just practice that banter. There's nothing to lose.
Yeah, definitely. I love that. And having worked a lot in retail and service industries, I can definitely confirm that it's a pretty low bar for being nice to serving staff, that actually it doesn't take much to be one of their favorite customers of the day. So,
and you're probably not going to be rejected. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, particularly if it's somewhere that takes tips, it's very much in their best interest to get along with you.
Yeah.
No, that's a great tip. I love that. So we'll just start to wrap up now. We are sadly coming to the end of our time. So if people are listening to this and are in a place where they want to make new friends and grow their social networks, are there any kind of general tips you have on how to meet new people as an adult?
Well, one, you might want to go check out my book. I think that is a helpful place to start. But I do think that always being on the lookout for new opportunities, you know, I think if you're not the person who's going to go up to somebody, engage, then look for somebody who's willing to talk to you. You know, the other day I was in my office building and, you know, this other lady just sort of came up and introduced herself as a new person in the office. And, you know, that could be a potential opportunity. So if you're looking to make friends as an adult, I would say, you know what, like seek out new opportunities. Don't lose sight of the opportunities that are all around you. And you know what, go deep, you know, follow up. You know, we've all been to like that party where we find a connection with somebody, where we think somebody's cool. And all too often, I would say people don't follow up. You know, we live in this world where virtual communities are becoming larger. We never want to lose sight of the importance of face-to-face interactions. That is actually what gives us that dopamine and that adrenaline and makes us feel good. And you know what? Like, even if you follow up and it lands flat, there are so many people in this universe that are probably wanting to be friends with you. And I also think about, you know, for people who do struggle with making friends, to consider why should people be friends with you, right? Because a lot of times people's insecurity and self-esteem can be a barrier. But I think it's actually like the self-talk, the self-awareness about what would make you a good friend, like why somebody should and want to be friends with you, is important for all of us to be thinking about all the time. That can actually just really help your self-esteem to put yourself out there.
Yeah, what I'm getting from that is you've got to know your strengths in order to put them forward.
Totally. And believe that somebody will want to see them and, you know, and will want to be your friend because of them.
Yeah, definitely. And we've certainly got other episodes people could listen to relating to that as well. But I also love what you said in terms of that approach of being very open to connections and just finding friendships where they pop up naturally. I am very much on record on this show as being a big extrovert, where I very much decide who is going to be my friend. And so when I'm in workplaces or I'm meeting people through the podcast, however I'm coming across new people, I'm very active in pursuing friendships. And that is very much my approach to life. But on the flip side, if you're not like that, there are extroverted people around you that are probably doing that. So if you remain open to that, if you, instead of focusing on like, okay, which friend can I capture? And instead focus on how can I be open to this friendship? If someone asks me out for a coffee, how can I be easygoing with the scheduling of it? Then that's the kind of the flip side of that approach.
Right. And, you know, I highly recommend that for people who are a little bit more introverted or suffer from social anxiety, buddy up with an extrovert, right, who knows your limitations. Because then you can sort of, you know, I've just found in my own lived experience, but also, you know, as a therapist, you kind of, you know, you can kind of become part of a group and then develop your own unique friendship. So, you know, for introverts, as much as you can handle, because I know that, you know, you need your alone time to recharge. You know, if you have that one extroverted buddy that can, you could go out with when you find that you're in the mood, like do it. Cause that actually can really just help you encounter more people that maybe you wouldn't ordinarily do on your own.
Definitely. I totally agree. Extroverts will just bring people around you. It's their nature. Yeah, I really love that interaction because it is so common. People describe like extroverts kind of adopting introverts, and that's definitely something I do. And there's definitely benefits from that both ways, as you've described. So we will wrap up there then. Listeners, I'm sure you'll have gathered by now, if you want to read Hope's book, it's full of incredible tips and strategies for making friends and developing existing friendships further in a whole array of scenarios. And she's really great at breaking down different environments, different approaches, things like self-esteem that you may need to work on. Is there anything you wanted to say about the book as well?
I think it offers some really helpful, concrete tools and worksheets. And I hope it's really helpful. It comes from a really meaningful place in my own life. And I hope it helps people. And you can get Here to Make Friends, How to Make Friends as an Adult on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Brilliant. And we'll drop a link for that in the episode description as well. So thank you so much for being part of the show today. It's been great chatting.
Thank you, Bobby.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.